In this workshop, we will mostly talk about some optimal detector configuration to improve sensitivity at high frequencies. And what is equally important is the science case for high frequencies. In particular, of course, we're going to target the neutron star equation of state, but also cosmological problems and multi-messenger astronomy, and even more exotic physics like excions and echoes. I know. Yanbei, are you going to talk about echoes?
I can.
Okay. We're going to talk about future facilities as well. Francisca, are you going to talk about future facilities?
I'm going to talk about the science case.
For future, yeah. For the current and the future, only for the current?
For the future detectors.
Or for the future detectors. Okay. Just inside of the introduction, this is the result of one of the main results of O2 that LIGO and Virgo network has detected a binary neutron star. With these parameters, I think most of you are familiar with this. And not only we were able to detect it, but we also could say something about the deformability of neutron stars. But this is just a start, because our current high frequency sensitivity is not as good as we would like it to be. However, we could find astrophysical rates with huge error bars, but still, and do some tests of gravity. And also using the optical counterpart, we were able to estimate the Hubble constant. In my opinion, this is a very interesting problem, that the Hubble constant don't agree between the cosmological observations and Stern and Kendall's. And I wonder if a gravitational wave detections will be able to clarify this issue. So next few slides, I will introduce you to the to the instrument science. I assume most of you know how LIGO works. So does anyone feel uncomfortable with, like, why LIGO has this many optical cavities? Oh, everyone understands why this, especially like non LIGO people. You guys think you understand LIGO really well?
Is it gonna be a pop quiz?
We don't understand it half the time, so it's okay to say.
Yeah. It's okay to review.
Yeah. Okay. I will just briefly mention, I guess, that so LIGO has four optical cavities, and two of them are this 4 kilometer long arm cavities, and gravitational waves are detected by measuring the differential signal between the two arms. We also have two extra cavities here. So this cavity here is kind of short. It's like 50 meter long. It's used to get rid of the imbalances in the two arms. So it turns out that, for example, you have some loss y in each of the arms. If this loss is different between the two arms, then it turns out that you start coupling laser noises, such as laser frequency noise and beam jitter noise from the laser. So this extra cavity, it just filters all the laser noises. This is why we have it. So the usual in this workshop, we'll talk a lot about the maximum power we can achieve in the arm cavities. It turns out to be a very important parameter because the sensitivity at high frequencies directly scales with the power that we can store in the arms. If you write the simple conservation of energy equation, so that if losses in each arm are almost equal, and we call it Y arm, it's usually around 50-80 ppm. And then the input power is around right now it's around 25 watts, but we would like to increase it towards 100 watts. Then you assume that you burn all the power on the arms, and then you can get up to like a megawatt power stored in the arms. Another way to improve sensitivity is to inject the so-called squeeze states of light. That's to improve the quantum shot noise. I think Aidan will tell us something about the limits of this system, right?
A little bit.
Yeah. A little bit. Yeah. Okay. And then finally, this signal recycling cavity. So we use it to shape the response of the antenna. So we can improve noise at low frequencies by compromising high frequencies, or vice versa, by tuning this cavity. This is the current sensitivity of LIGO, and you can see that at low frequencies we are mostly limited by auxiliary loops. So keep in mind we need to control all this. Cavities and also angular motion of these mirrors. And in the intermediate frequencies around 5 Hz, we are limited by the coating thermal noise. That's the thermal noise in the on the surface of the test masses, which reflects light. And this is very important and very, very difficult problem. It's very hard to solve this. Very hard to improve this noise, and in particular the cryogenic upgrade that I think Rana will mention will target this frequency band. But at the high frequencies we are all limited by this quantum shot noise, and the good news are that the other noises at these high frequencies are pretty low, so you need to improve only one noise, in some sense, to detect and to measure neutron star equation of state. So just as a reference, this is the post-merger signal from 1.4 solar mass BNS at 100 megaparsec. So if you can get down to this level of 10 to minus 24, then apparently you can do some interesting science. And it turns out that there's actually several ways how to achieve this, and this will be one of the two main topics of this workshop: how to get to this level of 10 to minus 24 strained root hertz. There are currently two ways. One is, it's very intriguing. It's called the white light cavity, and the point there is using a particular type of optomechanical interactions, you can increase the so-called gain bandwidth product. Remember I mentioned before that you can either make this noise a little bit lower at low frequencies, but also high frequencies will go up. That's because the gain bandwidth product is preserved in this optical cavities. However, it turns out there is a way how to keep good low frequency noise, but also I would also improve high frequency noise. So it sounds very counterintuitive. Yanbei, do you understand this? Why do you understand white light? Why is this possible?
Maybe.
Yes.
I understand more.
I'm not sure. I think. He understands, I guess.
Mathematically, I think.
Yeah, mathematically.
Yeah.
But like physically, what is like the simple explanation why white light cavity works?
There is no gain bandwidth product constraint.
Yeah, I understand, but it looks like so you accumulate dispersion in the passive cavity, and then you kind of cancel it. It sounds like a negative delay.
It's you create the negative dispersion, you make the cavity resonant in the wide band. That's the main thing. So, but if you make this cavity stable, this will not work. So this cavity have to be unstable, then you have feedback to make it stable. So in reality, after you feedback, your dispersion is not really negative dispersion anymore, but your signal response is.
Yeah. This part I understand, but But let's say you, but just physically, if you imagine you have a black, your interferometer is a black box, and then you don't know what is there. So you, there can be a negative dispersion media which is stabilized later on, or you can have some. It's not physical, but imagine you can put some negative delay in there. So from outside, you won't really know what's happening. Your sensitivity will be similar.
You can find it. It's just the same case as what happens in atomic systems or electronic systems, that in a narrow bandwidth, it may look like it's a negative time delay. But if you just make a more broadband measurement, you see that it's just a local effect. So there's no causality violation. It just looks like that if you measure it.
Yeah, there's no causality violation. All right. I think Thomas and Zhao can probably tell us more about this thing. We do work on the design of a proof of principle experiment at the University of Birmingham, and also MIT is thinking about this. And McGill has recently joined the effort, Jack Stanley. And another approach is more conventional one. So I think this one is more straightforward, but it's also a little bit difficult. So we need to increase arm power and squeezing level. So that's in the Aidan's talk. And then optimize signal recycling cavity for high frequencies. So recently there has been some work done on this where we employ the sloshing resonance between the arm cavity and the signal recycling. To put that resonance in about like 3 kilohertz, and then we can get this red curve, which is compared here with the other proposed detectors. And it turns out that the longer facilities don't help much at high frequencies, and in fact, there is a question: what is the optimal arm length for neutron star physics? Because, for example, 40 kilometers, we already have this pre-spectral range of the arm cavity at 3.7 kilohertz, and the noise at that frequencies will be pretty poor. So I thought Francisco will tell us something about the science case for this curve, but maybe you will talk about the longer facilities. That's also fine. So what are the limits of this red curve? And it's nice that we can reach 10 to minus 24 strained root hertz, but what is actually limiting it? So it turns out that the losses in the interferometer limit this curve. In particular, the loss in the signal recycling cavity. That's the biggest, our biggest offender, because it grows towards higher frequencies. Starting from the arm pole frequency, it goes up. The problem with the signal recycling cavity loss is that in order to reach a nice high frequency sensitivity, it turns out that you need to have pretty high finesse of the signal recycling. So this loss that you have is amplified inside, which makes the whole situation difficult. In particular, so where the loss comes from, like you increase the power and you create a lens in the substrate of the mirrors, in particular of the input test masses. So if I go back to this scheme, so the light gets in, and then here you resonate some power, and then you have absorption on the coating, and then because the profile of intensity follows the Gaussian form, then you will also have the thermal gradient here along the few silica. So these mirrors are made of glass or few silica, and you will create a lens here which will disturb the mode of this signal recycling cavity. So there will be mode mismatch between this mode and this mode, which is amplified, presently amplified by the signal recycling cavity. Yeah.
Is it necessary to have this mirror that you call SRM? What's the point?
This one?
Yeah.
Well, that's in order to increase just in order to shape the response of the interferometer. So in particular, in our case, so in advanced LIGO, the transmission of SRM is 35%, and then you get this pole frequency here of your interferometer around 400 hertz. But if you would like to shift this pole to higher frequencies and to open up this bandwidth further, then you need to have transmission of the SRM equal to around 1%.
So if you just remove it and then make the cavity itself have a wide bandwidth.
By lowering the harmfulness or other techniques.
That's right.
Yeah, so let's see, like if you...
As you said, if the arm is like 4 kilometers, then the first resonance is 37.5 kilohertz.
No, that's right. So our our optimization technique returns 1% for the following reason. So if you don't have SRM, then effectively your transmission is one. So let's say that's the case. So then you will have then in this case your bandwidth of the full interferometer will equal to the bandwidth of the arm, and then in this case to get bandwidth of let's say around a kilohertz,
you would like I guess 5 kilohertz or something.
Yeah, 5 kilohertz. Then your finesse of the arm cavity will be like 10 or so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like 3. Yeah, 3 or so. So then we sort of approaching the geo scenario in some sense. And then it turns out that the power through the beam splitter will create too much aberration.
Sort of just a technical problem.
Yeah, that's a technical problem. But you see, in our optimization, so we consider...
losses are a technical problem too.
Less technical.
Yeah, so here you see we consider the loss on the ITM from the wave distortion, but there will be also loss on the beam splitter. There is a similar equation for the beam splitter. And so it will turn out that in our calculation, it turns out that the contrast defect will be just so large because of the beam splitter loss. So we assume that we can cancel wavefront distortion by a factor of 3 and on beam splitter.
I guess what I'm saying is if you go to this extreme and just say we have a lot of laser power going through the glass, then the technical problem to solve is this kind of thing of removing the impurity from glass so that the absorption goes down, because the best optic in the world is the geo beam splitter, and that one is still not at any kind of fundamental quantum limit for absorption. It's just that's just the best as of 10 years ago or something. It's just a glass physics problem. So if you can just pay some company to make the glass cleaner and cleaner, possibly you can get another factor of 100, and then...
No, that's right. So in our optimization code, we assume, so how we introduce losses. So we say that the loss equals to, loss equals to the power in the arm. Well, for the beam splitter, will be power in the power cycling cavity, absorption coefficient, and then this is the cancellation factor that you can cancel this wavefront distortion using thermal compensation that Aidan will talk about. So currently, KITM equals to equals to 20. I think factor of 3 comes from thermal heating, and another like factor of 7-8 from CO2. I think right now that's around 20 to 30, right? How much you can cancel this thing? Yeah. So then I think what Rana is saying that you can in principle reduce this absorption coefficient to some much lower level, and then there is a similar equation for beam splitter, and then. And then indeed, as an optimal configuration, you will get, you might get something else. So the optimization returns parameters for the transmission of optics, indeed based on this, based on the practical things. So how far we can go. So in fact, I'm very excited about Aidan's talk to learn all this all these coefficients.
Yeah, I think he's going to have this detail about where the absorption comes from and what's the roadmap to getting to the one part per billion level.
Mm.
Has 2 days to prepare.
Yeah, actually,
yeah.
No, you're right.
Yeah. So there are these issues at high power that we in this design we try to balance. So in particular, we just talked about thermal lenses, but there is also a parametric instability problem. So it turns out that the mirrors, which are the test masses, which reflect light. So they have their own body modes around 10 to 15 kilohertz and also higher frequency harmonics. So it turns out that the radiation in the arms, it can excite these modes in using the positive feedback mechanism so that these modes are become resonantly amplified from some initial level determined by the thermal noise. However, there is a solution that is being tested right now. So put some little mushrooms on the test masses, which will have some large loss angle about around the modes, so that this body modes will be damped. So their Q factor will be smaller by a factor of 10 or 20. But the problem is then that the tail of this huge loss angle of the PI dampers will leak to 3 or 4 kilohertz. So the requirement says that the noise should not be amplified at 100 hertz right now. But if we talk about high frequencies, then we should think about a few kilohertz. So it's very challenging issue. So you need to have very high loss angle at 10 kilohertz, but then very small at like 3 or 4 kilohertz. Or 6 if you want to do 6. So I hope Jao will tell us about some solution about how to do it. Also the thermal effects that we just talked about. So in GEO, GEO experienced a lot of issues with this thermal lenses, and Harmut will tell us more about it. But that's a fundamental question, and I think we just briefly discussed it now. So what is the what is the limit? Like, how good can TCS be? So that's all applies for the current few silicon mirrors. But silicon is kind of nice. There are no thermal effects. Well, there is still heating, but the thermal conductivity is just so high that the gradient doesn't build up. So the heat just sort of distributes through the test mass very quickly, and you don't get a lens. That's why this Voyager upgrade.
With the increase in power, you still get some.
You still get some.
Residual lens, which is of your advanced LiDAR lens. But.
Oh, I should add this then to the list of questions. For how much power you would expect this to happen?
Oh, we had 3 megawatts and exactly how much absorption, maybe. 3 watts absorbed, I think, into...
Yeah, but then what is the strength of the lens compared to your LiGO?
The strength of the lens was 80% of the advanced LiGO.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
I think it's less.
You know, some of these numbers have changed a little bit. It might be like 50%, but it's the same magnitude. So.
But I thought the thermal conductivity is just much, much higher.
Well, the thermal conductivity is much higher, but the thermorefractive coefficient is higher.
I see.
You get a smaller temperature gradient, but you have a slightly larger.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Thermal effect.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't. Okay.
It's not fundamental. It's not fundamental. No. And you know the surface deformation is a lot less because the thermal expansion coefficient. That's really where that kind of no thermal effects is on the surface because the thermal expansion coefficient's gone to zero. At cryogenic temperatures.
Yeah, that's right. So Rana will tell us more. So one interesting question that I would like to know is what is the limit? What is the power limit that that LIGO can reach in the arm cavity? So for a few silica mirrors, it looks like 3-4 megawatt is already close to maximum based on these numbers. If you can improve absorption and wavefront distortion more, then you can get higher power. But with our current technology, it looks like 3-4 megawatt is maximum. So what is maximum for Voyager? Hope to learn this from Rana's talk. So why Voyager is also nice is that because the loss in the signal recycling can be smaller because the wavelength is larger, so you scatter less. And also, if we can somehow fix this scattering to the high order modes, then we can also improve the relative mode matching between the arm and signal recycling. And then this signal recycling cavity loss in this figure for Voyager can be way smaller. So also, Voyager is nice because the classical noises turned out to be smaller. So the whole point of Voyager is that the coating thermal noise, well, one of the key points of Voyager is the coating thermal noise will be down by a factor of few. And so you can, in principle, try to improve your sensitivity even further down than 10 to minus 24 strain root curves. But the fundamental question is also the following: how do we construct the cost function for our instrument? In particular, we can try to reach good sensitivity towards higher frequencies, but then the overall level will be higher. Or we can compromise higher frequencies and make the whole thing smaller, like around 1 or 2 kilohertz, and this should be driven by the science case. And the I don't think we still have the good answer for this. This is what I would like to learn from this workshop. How do we convert the science case into the cost function? It looks like there is just too many parameters right now. How to tune it? This just shows you that if we reach this 10 to minus 24 level or maybe a little better, then we should be able to distinguish between different equations of state. It's fine. But then what are the further problems? Of course, number one issue for high frequency detectors is the neutron star equation of state. So I think William and Andreas, and maybe Yan Bei, will will devote their talks to these issues. I'm not sure I met William or Andreas yet. Okay. So I think Andreas got a RC starting grant to study neutron stars, right? So that's using numerical models. And one interesting question there is, so what are the limits of this numerical simulation? So it looks like right now you can mostly accurately simulate the fundamental mode, but what about the P waves? So why you can't accurately know the Q factors and the frequencies of the P waves? Or maybe you already can.
Generally, frequencies are something that one can determine relatively robustly. Different thing is the exact phase evolution and things like the collapse time, for instance. That's something that is, if we are honest to ourselves, we must admit that it's impossible to predict the collapse time screen, for instance.
Okay.
It's too much affected by numerics and too much affected by physics that we don't, which we are not really able to model it. And we won't be within the next 10, 20 years.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, that is, you have minus 5 minutes.
That's right.
Keep the discussion later.
That's right, yeah, I see it. So the other things, we'll talk at this workshop about the ultralight particles. I don't think I met Masha. Masha in this room?
She's not here.
Not here, okay. And cosmology, and also Alberto will introduce us to the exciting field of multi-messenger astronomy. Very much looking to learn about it. In the science case, we'll also cover, I think Eric will talk about astrophysics with population inference. Is that about right? And I think the consensus is that Yan Bei should talk about something very new that he comes out during this workshop. But if he can't, then talk about black holes and neutron stars. Yeah, that's a consensus. And finally, so for the future detectors, I would like to make a point that even 4 kilometer detectors in the future might be useful. So for example, in this diagram, we show the maximum SNR and number of detections per year that we can do with 4 kilometers optimized for high frequency and compared with current design of ET and Cosmic Explorer. So you can see that the lengths helps a lot for black holes, but not that much for high frequencies. For example, in this plot, we try to see what's the optimal arm length for neutron stars. And this is optimized for some different parameters that we call TITM, but in principle, 40 kilometers is not necessarily optimal for neutron star science. But this is very preliminary. Okay, that's it. So let's get started.